This is The Naturalist. In every episode, we're covering the products, ideas, and trends that are shaping the CPG industry.
Or that we just really like.
Gen Z. We've been down this rabbit hole before.
We have. We've been talking a lot about Gen Z.
They're an important generation, and in fact, maybe the most important generation and perhaps the most aligned generation with the natural and organic product industry.
So just to give a little bit of context, because I always have to go look this up every time, Gen Z, we're talking about people that were born between 1997 and 2012. So a huge range of ages.
Just barely missed it.
Just barely.
Me or you.
Me.
Both of us. Yeah, no, it is a range, which is important to note as people in the natural product industry think about how they're marketing or speaking to, and also recognizing that a lot of these consumers are entering the workforce and are attracted to mission-driven companies, not just for the products they purchase, but for the careers that they pursue.
So it's a big age range, but it's also a big diversity of purchasing interests,
yeah,
what they're looking for.
Yeah, and I think they're a huge part of this shift towards a more multicultural products industry. And that's really cool to see the curiosity that they're taking to the grocery store. And they are shopping in stores.
Yeah.
Which is a little counter to what we were expecting. You know, I would expect Gen Z to be purchasing only online through social platforms, subscription models, but they're really shopping in store, including Costco, which is what
one of
the things we talked to Junjo Lee about. She was incredible.
Yeah, she really was. I thought that was so fascinating. And she brought up so many other interesting things about Gen Z, just their quest for authenticity, their interest in, obviously, in environmental, social, health concerns. I'm wanting that authentic voice, the diversity, but also things that are quirky, that are innovative. I feel a lot of hope thinking about Gen Z.
Yeah, and I think some of those contradictions that we see in Gen Z are actually really important to think about this non-binary approach to life and this flexitarian approach. They're open to technologies and seeing what role technology can play in a more sustainable industry while also wanting to connect with the people and the ethos behind their products. So it's some of these really interesting things of like, yeah, we can be all of these things. And I think Gen Z is proving that. And I also love what Junjo Lee specifically talks about is a relationship with food, not just the trends that we're seeing, but why are we seeing those? Why are people making these choices? And with Gen Z, it's a lot about connection and emotion and caring.
Community,
So Junjo Lee is a food ethnographer.
Coolest job title in the universe.
It is, I know. She's worked, I believe, on Starbucks, Google, all different big corporations to understand the why behind decision making and behind trends.
And she joined the keynote address, the State of Natural and Organic at Expo West, which was not that long ago.
It was not that long ago. And the conversation we had with her was at Expo West. So you will hear a little bit of that background noise, maybe a "It's Expo West,"
which I love. Puts us right back where we were.
Yeah. But it was on the show floor, so all that great energy. And she had wonderful reflections, not only on what she shared on stage, but also what she was seeing on the show floor and what it means for the future. Yeah.
All right. Well, enjoy the interview with Junjo Lee.
Well, can you introduce yourself and your background a little bit before we jump in?
My name is Junjo Lee, and I am a food ethnographer. I study people, consumers, shoppers, users in their relationship with food and everything else. And my background, I studied medical and cultural anthropology.
And how long have you been doing this work?
Since 2005. So I started out at a small consumer research firm where we applied anthropology to consumer research.
Yeah.
So it's been a while.
I have to say, when I was reading about you, I saw what you do, food ethnographer, and I immediately thought, I definitely want to be that. It's the coolest title I've ever heard. I want to be that. How do I do it? And what can you teach us?
Yeah, it's really fun, and it's evolved over the years. And I guess I've been doing it long enough where I am part of the historic data tracking, like when I started back in 2005. I think the big brands were just learning about minimally processed foods and trying to understand that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you've been a part of this whole cultural shift around food and how we interact with food. Well, multiple shifts, right? It's constantly changing.
Yeah, it is constantly changing and evolving because food is a reflection, expression of who we are, our identities. And so we don't stay static. So the foods we eat don't stay static.
Are there specific areas within kind of the broader food culture or food ethnography that really interest you, you know, that spark your passion? Are there specific areas that you're just really focused on right now? Or
yes, there are some. I just came back from Korea. This is my third fermentation exploration. And Fermentation Day in Korea is typically around January or February. So this year it was February 21st or 4th. And I took Sandra Katz, the world famous fermenter who wrote The Art of Fermentation and Wild Fermentation. It was his first trip to Korea, so that was fun. So three anthropologists plus a fermenter exploring fermentation in Korea. So very curious about fermentation and microbial relationships with humans. And I'm also interested in mushrooms.
Lots of both of those things on the show floor. Lots of fermented foods, lots of mushrooms. So to see those things popping up so significantly in packaged products is interesting. And then your work to really like understand what does it mean in the origin stories and how do consumers interact with them. That's so important so that it's not suddenly just a trend on a store shelf with no context.
I would distinguish there's fads, there's temporarily pops of interesting things that make us happy and, you know, curious. And then there's long-term cultural shifts.
Yeah.
And so you might call them trends, but I'm very interested in tracking early signals. And so, yeah, fermentation, fungi, and forests are part of those.
I think that speaks to both of us quite a bit because, you know, we do a lot of trend and forecasting work at New Hope because, of course, we're seeing so much and having the opportunity to talk to so many brilliant people. I'm curious from your perspective, what are some of those key early signals that a fad is actually going to be a long-lasting trend or even cultural force?
So a lot of threads, I think. When fads ladder up to a larger open signifier, like organic used to be, a big open wide signifier, meaning fresh. Well, step back, fresh probably is what drove this industry because natural, organic, local, seasonal, all laddered up to fresh as a quality marker. And I think right now, I've been tracking regenerative as an open signifier and really trying to see where it lands, if there's legs to it, if it's sticky, how it evolves in culture. And I think it has some major threads, but I think it can also have some problems if we start closing it off and trying to control the attributes too quickly. I think it might just become like natural organic and these others, ladder up to fresh, but I hope it doesn't because I think it has the capacity and potential to hold so much of what we all care about here at this industry.
Yeah, we've been having some really interesting conversations this week, one of them on the podcast about regenerative and how can we open it up? I mean, exactly, you know, is it opening it up from soil health to now it's climate health or is it's nutrient density or all these different, like you said, threads. I'll be really interested to see too how that broadens rather than narrows and becomes more applicable to more people or more versatile, I guess, to different people's lives. So interesting.
So the work I do is to hear what people share in common. So I listen to a lot of people in different contexts. And I'm looking for or hearing for patterns And when I started really holding regenerative and seeing what people are saying about it, the meanings they're putting on it, the values they associate with it, at the essence, I think it means caring more. And at the highest essence, it really represents caring more and connecting deeper and curing myths of separation. So all the silos and blockers that keep us apart. So I'm hopeful. I think it has a lot of legs.
I love that. I do too. I love it. And I do also want to, I think that's a good transition maybe into a question I've been having since the State of Natural. But just this, I don't necessarily think it's a tension, but it's something that struck me as interesting that Gen Z, which I want to really dig into Gen Z because you've done so much great work there. But when it comes to certifications, that's not something that's a high priority outside of organic for Gen Z shoppers. And then in regenerative, that's something that there's been a lot of all these different certifications emerging and trying to kind of quantify it. So I feel like the CPG industry and certainly the ag industry, the sustainable ag industry, are all trying to kind of quantify impact. And that doesn't seem that important to Gen Z. Is that an inaccurate assumption based on what I heard? And how do we address that potential tension of quantifying versus just wanting something that you can connect with?
Wow, Jessica, that is a black hole question. And I have an odd answer to it.
Okay, I'm ready and excited.
Okay. So when I was working at the Hartman Group, this is some time ago, we were very interested in the beverage category, the single serve chilled beverage, the wall, that you would go to Whole Foods and you'd go there to see, oh, what are all the new trends and fads popping up? Because you saw it all on that wall. And I think some years before that wall happened, people pretty much drank Pepsi or Coke. You know, it was, and brands believed in loyalty. And so there was brand loyalty, and you were either a Pepsi person or a Coke person. And then there was this just creative explosion of all these single-serve chilled beverages. And it was fun. It was new. It was interesting. There was so much choice and play. And in some ways, I think certification got us to a point where now we can have common language and start talking about these things, and that there may be a lot of certification that pops up, but I don't think certification exists in that era anymore where information used to be a little bit more limited. We were all becoming more food literate and eco-literate, and I think we're there. I think this younger generation coming up, they grew up with all of that. So it's sort of seeped into us. So I think, sure, you know, you can look at this sort of the story or actually see what's happening on a live stream link. There's so many ways to see the story. And so I don't know about certification. And then we run into another problem, which is around our now much more nuanced and sensitive way of thinking about different cultures. And, you know, the impact of like a US-based certification system then imposing these attributes to other countries, other farmers, other suppliers.
Yeah.
And so there's a cultural bias in some of these.
Oh, that's interesting. No, this is great. I mean, we could go way down this path, as you said, but I think, I mean, it is interesting to think about certifications as a relatively quick and easy way to communicate value years ago, right? And now there's all these other tools available and all these other considerations. And in different conversations I've been having too, and I know it came up in the presentation as well, but it's a non-binary world now. We don't need to have these really clear definitions of everything that I think people were once seeking as a way to feel secure and grounded. And I think we're moving outside of that, perhaps.
I think we're certainly seeing that from a lot of, I mean, we have 800 something new exhibitors, and not all of them are young brands, but a lot of the brands that have really young founders, that's what they say. You know, we don't have this certification, but we have all of these things, and we have this story, and we have this message, and that's not as important to us as this and this and this and this. You know, I like that you said, like, the non-binary world. I think that that is what a lot of these young brands are saying.
And Adrian, we were talking earlier, and you mentioned discomfort, the sweet spot between discomfort and growth. And I think that's where this younger generation is trying to learn to be okay being in that sweet spot of being uncomfortable, not always knowing, sometimes being a little anxious about it because they think about a lot of things and feel a lot of things, but being okay, being uncomfortable and discomfortable in the gray areas and the liminal spaces between all the nuances and all the uncertainty.
You know, I've had some interesting, I mean, just latching onto that idea of discomfort and taking it probably to a completely different space, but I've had some really interesting conversations about that on the floor at Expo West about topics like women's health, or I was talking to Medicine Mama. They have this on-the-go vulval cream that just won a Nexty, and they're saying, you know, we're just trying to talk about vulvas. We want to talk about these things that make people super uncomfortable. And I've had that same conversation with five or six other brands that they're like, we don't talk about this stuff. Let's talk about this stuff. We need to talk about women's constipation. Nobody talks about that. And I think that that's been really interesting to see just from in this world, people breaking away from, let's have those uncomfortable conversations and get those things out in the open. And again, this is a total tangent from what you're talking about, but I think it's just been fascinating, and it feels liberating even just as an observer to see that.
I remember 12, 15 years ago when probiotics and the yogurt category was really entering into the scene and people were really uncomfortable talking about digestive transit and
making you regular with air quotes.
We didn't talk about those sorts of things, and I think now it's pretty open.
Do you think that, because it is interesting how we then see many more of these products and then research being invested in science, such as in women's health and various aspects of women's health. Do you think those things are driven by the industry, the proliferation of these products and in new categories, or by consumers, or both?
I think it's driven by the founders of these companies, and so many of the founders were here. That's why this is such an amazing event. And still, it's that story that got this industry, I think, started in the early days, was there was a need. There wasn't a way to solve. And so they decided to make it and create it. And so I really do think it is, I love maker culture, and I love people who make things for the world that we need. And it still is relational. It still is so many families are here, family businesses. I don't know if it's necessarily that consumer driven, or I think it's still in some ways the way this industry started from.
Yeah, yeah.
It does definitely feel like it's trickling up, you know, through generations. It's those young brands again. It's those young founders that are breaking those barriers and bringing a lot of those products and those ideas to light. And then that's kind of making its way up through the more established companies. And yeah, it's fascinating.
Yeah, then they influence, and then the larger, more established companies are paying attention.
Yeah.
And see. But I've been going around asking founders, so what got you started? Why, you know, where did where did this idea come from? And it's just been so fun hearing everyone's stories.
What has there been a key idea that's emerged from that question that you've asked, like something that surprised you about founders' stories or motivation?
That it's deeply personal still. It's really still deeply personal. I haven't heard anyone say, well, we saw a market gap and a need in this and thought we could. The reasons are all very personal, but it really ladders up to caring more. So I have two Gen Zers, and they were both caught in the height of the pandemic when they were in college. So they had to come back. We empty nested, moved from a large suburban house to a two-bedroom apartment in San Francisco. So they came back and lived with us in our two-bedroom. And my daughter and I were talking, and she was talking about learning and how you develop a career or something. And she said, you know, it really starts with caring more. Caring more is the way to learn about something, and the way to master something. Is learning to care is the beginning of that journey.
How does that relate to Gen Z's relationship with food? Because I like so many aspects of your talk here, but I think the curiosity, the connection on a really emotional level that Gen Z consumers have with food. I think there is, like, I wrote it down, I don't have my notes here, but it was something like food flavors and textures are emotional medicine. I think that was something that you said. So where is that coming from, and how does that relate to caring more?
Another very difficult question. Your questions. You know, I think it's really hard to talk about food when you grow up in a culture that doesn't talk about it. I remember I was doing a market research project for Starbucks. They had launched their HPP, high pressure pasteurization juice product. And so we were interviewing juice drinkers in a higher price point range. And I remember going to Georgia, Atlanta, and there was this guy, he had forgot we were coming. I had two brand managers behind me, and he showed up in his boxers. He had just gotten out of bed. But we met, it was all great. And we sat down and we started talking, and he said, you know, I grew up really, really poor. My mom was single mom, a nurse, and then I got a chance to study abroad and went to France. And he said, they talked about their food. And it was the first time he had been in a culture where they were talking about the textures and flavors, and they were talking about the farmer up the street and the winemaker over there. And it just, a light bulb went in, because, you know, he grew up not in that kind of culture. And I think the internet, I mean, I don't want to point all fingers to the internet, but the internet has really provided a way for us to share and exchange our food discoveries, learn how other people talk about it and articulate it and make it. And I think it's really facilitated our conversations and deepened our way of communicating about food beyond just yuck or yum.
Yeah. I mean, I was just thinking about the phenomena, you know, when blogs started and food bloggers, and then the photos of people's meals, and then the memes about if I see another photo of somebody's meal, and then now just it's the community and the sharing recipes and sharing where things come from. And I mean, I just, wow. Yeah, that was an incredible observation.
Like a tool, and it's a real tool for a vehicle for connecting, which I think food has always been, but we've lost that. Mm-hmm. And I think that, I mean, we've been talking a lot about, like, both the deconstructing of the CPG industry, going like back to basics, which I believe is you know, in the natural products industry started as a return to kind of its core and to natural, whole, real foods, but, you know, has obviously evolved, which has many great aspects to it. But now this return not only to like food in a truly pure form, but then the other things that come from that, connecting over food, understanding each other and different cultures over food. I think that whole world is so beautiful, and that food can be a key driver of our connections. And it starts with talking about it and sharing a meal. So yes, very beautifully stated. Thank you.
I know it's a pretty obvious answer, so that's why I hesitated, but I really think it's that.
Yeah, no, it's a great answer. Yeah. It's, yeah.
I mean, I think Americans too, this is such a big country. I mean, we're so far removed from, you know, if we live in Colorado, how far away are we from orange production in Florida? I mean, we're so far away physically from the production of a lot of things that we eat, and then also just emotionally, mentally from the communities that are producing those things that are on our table. And I find that in cultures like France or in Spain, where I used to live, where people talk about food all the time, but this food comes from places that are very close to where they live. And so I think about that all the time here, just that we're far away from each other. And I think that food has the potential to bring us together, to create that community. But we have to, you know, overcome those really long distances. And
exactly that. Food was relational. And in the early 2000s, when I was doing this research and we started doing generational research, we talked to boomers, baby boomers, and Gen Xers, millennials. Gen Zers were way too young still. And the boomers many are a generation and a half away from the farm. So we weren't so far from the farm, actually. And we had those memories. And then lost them, I think.
Yeah.
That food is relational. It became, food was about attributes on the packaging. And I think we became a country that had to read their food on the packaging versus have the relational foods. And I think now with our growing technologies and ways of connecting, I think it's returning to that relational, which is why maybe certifications are less important now. Yeah, you can have a relationship.
Yeah, and it's like maybe the future is that right balance of the intellectual and relational piece of it, because I feel like understanding attributes and ingredients and all of that, to your earlier point, was so important to kind of changing how we buy products and the types of products that we purchase. But now, how do we build the relationship with the foods again? That feels like where we need to go and where Gen Zers are pushing. I'm curious, from the work that you did with Catherine and Carlotta and Nick, and weaving that in with all of your great insights, did you have any aha moments from that work of where you think the food industry is going that you kind of gleaned based on what you found through your research and what they shared around where the industry numbers are going?
Yeah, it was so fun to work with them because my ends are very small and qualitative. I may talk to about 200 Gen Zers in a year. I think our stories aligned so nicely, actually. And a few areas where we talked about was, where is the premium market, the better for you? And I had suggested maybe it was international. So internationalization is the new premium. And I think the numbers were there to suggest that. And another area that I found really interesting, we don't have numbers yet, but Gen Zers are shopping at Costco. And, you know, when my kids were little and I was shopping at Costco, it was because I had a big family.
Yeah.
And now they're going there because they like value, good value, and that's price sensitive, but also values sensitive. and the quality of the products you can get. And so it was really interesting to see that they weren't all shopping online in subscription, you know, kind of services. That I think Nick mentioned that they are shopping more in store than online in some ways, but also breaking this idea of who the Costco shopper is.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Too, was really interesting.
I guess we're all Costco shoppers in the seems like we're all, but that is interesting. The behaviors, which some of that just to me says things are actually moving in a different direction than we thought they were going to. The trajectory doesn't mm-hmm. quite seem linear from what we would have predicted just a couple of years ago in terms of younger consumers and how they engage.
Yeah. So it was really interesting. We had posed the question last year, how does more than enough feel? And the Gen Zers answered by saying, really bad. I feel like I'm going to throw up when I hear more than enough. And what they were actually expressing, what they heard in that question, which wasn't my intention, can we have more than enough for everyone? That was my intention of asking the question. What they heard and reflected back was, it's more than enough. And resources are so limited. We should have...
Oh, like gluttony or greed or...
Or better than or super okay. special uh-huh. or like luxury or premium or...
I see, okay.
That whole area, what they're thinking is enough for everyone. And everyone being enough. And so they're really talking about waste and how waste hurts, but they're also talking about how, because waste is a resource out of place, but they're really talking also that they are resources and they don't want to feel like waste. They're early in their careers and they want to find jobs that are impactful, are creative, that contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought that was really interesting in our conversations that came up.
That are worth their time, no? That are worth their effort. And I respect that so much. I wish I had had that lesson when I first started out.
It feels really encouraging.
Yeah, it does.
Just the future of how people are consuming products, but how they're entering the workforce and choosing mission-aligned careers
and being so
intentional. That they're passionate about. This feels good.
Yeah.
To me, the future is bright.
I'm really excited and hopeful for our future.
Thank you so much. What a great conversation this has been, first of all. And I'm just kind of just hanging on a lot of the things that you said. But before we wrap up, is there anything else that you would want to share that has kind of come out of this week at Expo West that you're excited to pursue in your work?
So... my collaborator, Kirsten, and I, we have launched an ethnographic pop-up called Restaurant on Mars. What would a Michelin star restaurant serve on Mars? And it's really constructed around this idea of extreme constraints. So when you have extreme constraints, it almost feels like no constraints, almost, because it's just too much. And I think that's where a lot of creativity comes out from. And it's actually really a question about Earth. How can we rewrite the menus, retell the stories, remake this world that we are here on to flourish and thrive? And so I just want everyone to know that stories around terminal timelines and peak population and climate catastrophe can be devastating. They are devastating and painful. And that our kids are just at the start line of their lives, of their careers, their work lives. And so how can we resource the worlds they want to live in is what I would love to end our conversation with. And I've seen so many companies here, so many businesses trying that. And so I'm really hopeful. There's so many cool ideas. I think We are having a re-relationing around the idea of processed. Used to be, you know, heavily processed was bad and low, minimal was good. I think this next generation is open and curious about the new technologies coming out and how it might create a more nourishing and delicious world for everyone.
Thank you.
Just love you. You're great. You're very inspiring. Yeah. Thank you so much
for being here and being such a big part, a significant part of the show this year, and for taking time to talk to us. We really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you both.
All right, it's time for the list.
The Gen Z list.
The Gen Z list. And just to be clear, so these are products that were exhibitors at Expo West, brands that we're exhibiting, but they're ones that are really aligned with those values that we've talked about in the interview, those values that are really important to Gen Z.
Yes.
So the first one of the brands we want to highlight, this was all anyone could talk about at the show, or at least in the circles I was running in the non-alcoholic pavilion circles, for better or for worse. This is such a cool non-alcoholic cocktail brand. And it was founded, it's all botanicals, it's herbs. There's no flavorings added. All those things are macerated in neutral alcohol. It's kind of reverse engineered to pull that alcohol out. So it's really appealing to that growing sober curious, non-drinking movement. And the really cool thing about this brand, not only are the products incredible, they're these really dry, bitters-driven, they have that experiential feel. So they're really creating that experience. Their message is all about embracing occasion, community, creating opportunities to forge richer relationships. And I really love that. So, and their goal is to create this healthier, more inclusive culture. So just a really cool brand.
I'm in.
I'm in too. For better or for worse?
For bitter, I say.
You would say that.
All right. Next up, we have OEM, which is a really simple, thoughtfully crafted beauty brand. I think that the simplicity of this, with products that range from ointments for skin conditions, scrapes and cuts, to cream to clear the airways. So it's kind of this pharmacy approach to beauty. They actually call themselves the Apple of drugstores. So, hey. I'm on board with that. I'm an apple gal. What can I say? They also have a rehydrating drink to replenish electrolytes. So really that whole wellness approach to beauty. And I just think that when we look at Gen Z and their desire to scale back on products, to be really conscious about resources and what they're using, just a company that's positioned like this and marketed like this, I think really resonates with that type of shopper that, you know, shies away from abundance. And I like that.
Yeah, I love it. Their branding is so beautiful, too.
Yeah, it makes me feel clean just looking at it.
Alrighty. Next brand is Mila. So if you're at the State of Natural, one of the data points that I really loved, they were talking about pot stickers. Pot stickers are huge right now. And the fact that 58% of Gen Z has eaten a globally inspired dish during the last week versus 19% of boomers. I think that was a data point from Spins.
Wow.
And Mila is a brand that I absolutely love. They have all kinds of different products, but their soup dumplings are the most outstanding things.
I still haven't tried them.
Oh, so good. They have this beautiful branding. They're second generation Chinese Americans. And their whole message is about connecting cultures, that authenticity again, clean label, empowering communities to show up in ways that make them feel comfortable. They talk about exploring people's self-identity, leading with your identity. It's just a delicious product, beautifully packaged, with a great message behind it. What's not to love?
Let's have soup dumplings right now.
Let's go get some right after this.
Do you have any?
I might be able to come up with some.
Do you? Okay, next up, Chamberlain Coffee. So American social media personality Emma Chamberlain, your favorite.
My favorite.
She rose to internet fame through her YouTube channel and podcast. She's an influencer, has worked in fashion, business, has collaborated with Vogue, Lancome, Louis Vuitton, the works. She's out there.
She's
in
the real deal.
She's the real deal. She launched her online mail order coffee company, Chamberlain Coffee, back in 2019. Now it's everywhere, right?
Yeah.
Like, Chamberlain Coffee is everywhere. And so obviously because of her persona and Gen Z consumers' familiarity with her, that was a shoe-in for this company. So there it is. And I think we just continue to see more and more influencers and social media personalities coming out with their own products that are aligned with their kind of positioning.
And, you know, talking about contradictions, I think it's interesting that one of the data points, again, from the presentation was that Gen Z maybe doesn't care as much about certifications as they could or they might, but they do care a lot about clean label. So I just thought it was really interesting because this is a USDA certified
organic.
And they care about organic. So this is an organic brand. And again, I just love that kind of two things living in the same coffee cup,
yeah,
if you will.
In your mug.
In my mug. Okay. Not to be confused with Mila, this next brand is Mela. This is a watermelon-based beverage. You may have seen it. It's got electrolytes, it's antioxidants. It's all about the benefits of watermelon water in replenishing those essential minerals. They're really brightly colored. The branding's really eye-catching. They are all over social media, and they just got into 7-Eleven, which is super Gen Z store choice, I've been told by my Gen Z friends.
Yeah? Mm-hmm. 7-Eleven?
Yeah, that's the word.
Interesting. Hot Dang is a mother-daughter brand, which I just love. Kelly Mee Lee, who is on the Netflix show, have you seen it, Bling Empire?
I have not.
She's on that show, and she really wanted to develop something that was based around her mom's recipes and things that her mom would cook from scratch. So she developed something that was reminiscent of some of the traditional childhood dishes that she ate when she was growing up. And I wanted to highlight this not only because it's a really cool story and the product and company caught my attention at Expo, but because one of the things that June Jolie talked about in terms of flavor profiles that are really connecting with Gen Z is spice. And I just have been seeing spice everywhere. And I do think that represents this bigger cultural shift away from sweet, and into both more unique flavors, different types of flavor profiles. And nothing represents that more than a spicy profile, right? And Gen Z, and I mean, I'm putting hot sauce on everything. And it's just interesting to see that that's kind of the flavor profile that stands out for this generation.
Love it. All right, well, that's it for the list. Don't forget to rate and subscribe. Want to be on The Natural List? Send us an email at thenaturalist@newhope.com.